from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is a special edition of On Point before a live audience at the Paramount Theater in Boston. To our guests in the hall and listeners around the country, welcome to On Point. We love taking On Point out to our listeners. We have done it all over the country: Nashville, New Orleans, L.A., Thousand Oaks. We broadcast from St. Paul, Denver, Charlotte, New York, even Shanghai. Right now, it's Boston, and we're talking American health and health care with famed surgeon, writer, thinker, Dr. Atul Gawande. He's been watching American medicine from the operating room to the Rio Grande, how we handle our personal health and the nation's health care, Obamacare and beyond. This hour On Point, we're sitting down with Dr. Atul Gawande to talk about the future of American health care and American health. We are recording this show before a live audience at the beautiful Paramount Theater in downtown Boston. We've invited questions from our audience here and across the country online on Facebook and Twitter. We are loaded for bear, so let's go. Joining me now on stage is Dr. Atul Gawande, surgeon, writer, and public health researcher. He's a general and endocrine surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, teaches at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Harvard Medical School. Famously, he's a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine, author of Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science, Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance, and The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right. And coming this fall, his Being Mortal. Dr. Atul Gawande, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. This is a man who does surgery in the morning and writes in the afternoon, or you'll tell us how you divide your time. One of the pieces you wrote, perhaps most famously, came just as we were heading into the heart of the healthcare debate that ultimately led to Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. President Obama reportedly sort of waved your New Yorker story in front of senators gathered at the White House and said, this is the problem, this is what we need to address. And in that story, which took place in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas, McAllen, Texas, you were describing a hospital with some of the highest cost in the country. It was shocking to read why it happened, how it happened, in part because doctors owned the hospital, so when they prescribed lots of surgeries and medicines, it came back to their benefit. So here's my question for you to start. If that was part of the inspiration for what put this big reform on the rails, and it's got great supporters and it's got great detractors, and now a lot of people signed up, did this reform solve that problem?
Clearly not. The story was the story of the variation in our health care. It was a county. It was not just a hospital. It was really a county that was the most expensive county in the country for Medicare patients. And you could go up the border of up the Texas border to El Paso and find a place that was half the cost and had better quality of outcome. And the puzzle was, why would that be? And what we saw was that just trying to provide coverage was part of the answer, but wasn't going to address the delivery system, which is broken. When you have a system that pays for quantity, does not pay for quality, does not reward for health, you can end up in a place like McAllen, where you had tremendously high costs, more than $17,000 per person on Medicare in a year, when El Paso was at $8,000. Now, the striking question wasn't, why McAllen? The interesting puzzle was, why wasn't everywhere else just like McAllen? They were simply following what the incentives were. And the answer is that, there's a variety of things that have held us back. The culture of medicine, professionalism, wanting to see that we don't just turn it into a business. But that pressure is still there. But we're in the midst of a dramatic transformation in the way that healthcare is delivered, happening now over the last 3 years.
We all know it's a business. They know it's a business. Within months of the time that article came out, there were big reports coming out about how much they were contributing politically, because they didn't want changes to the law that would cut them off from this very high profit business they were doing. Some of the biggest political contributors in all of Texas, some of the biggest political contributors in the country, not just out of any hospitals, but right out of McAllen, Texas, that you were reporting on, Nancy Pelosi taking money there and many others, it said that that money influenced the shape of the reform that finally came, that they ended up kind of winners here, and the problem that we saw there wasn't really fixed. I'm reading here, this is from Jean Mitchell. She's an economist at Georgetown University's Public Policy Institute, saying this is a disgrace. Talk about a law that's backfired. And I think she's talking about cherry-picking patients so their outcomes would look good. They would be rewarded even under Obamacare. Am I right?
Well, understand a couple of things. One, Obamacare has the portion of it that said, we are going to cover our population of people who don't have coverage today. And the commitment to covering all of the uninsured that came across from Obamacare, that is a basic moral commitment. And in many ways, the debate over whether we're going to do that is over. We are now debating more how we're going to do it than whether we're going to do it. I
mean, so you say, a lot of politicians still on the hustings would hasten to disagree right there. I assume it'll still be a big issue in the midterm campaigns for the fall.
Yes, there's the argument that, you know, repealing Obamacare and removing the coverage provisions is something that you have conservative Republicans wanting to make happen. But the reality is we now have, here, let me give you the most simple example, which comes from my own family. My son has a heart condition that would make him uninsured. When he just graduated from high school this very week.
Congratulations.
And, yes, we're excited. He's going out into the world. And first of all, under Obamacare, he can remain covered under our family insurance till the age of 26. Mm-hmm. That is a massive change. Second, he would have a very difficult time getting insurance on his own. He's someone who wants to perhaps go into design, go into architecture. A lot of those folks are self-employed, would be in small businesses. And getting coverage, he would be have a pre-existing condition with his heart condition. It's a serious heart condition. He's had to have procedures more than a couple of times. And he would simply not get insurance. We've adopted, as a country, the expectation and set the standard that we are going to make sure that a child like him will be covered for the rest of his life. And that is, we are having the debate over whether that's going to continue. But the reality is that now with more than 16 million people having picked up coverage and more coming down the pike, mm-hmm. that people are not going to take that away, and there's going to be a lot of fighting if you take that away, and certainly you'll see me fighting if you take that away from my son.
Critics say, we hear the applause in the hall, Dr. Pugawande ready to fight. You're not the only one, and critics say it could still collapse under its own weight. And even some who may support it worry about this, that as these formulas work through, premiums may spike. We may see Americans preferring to pay penalties rather than high premiums. And here's just this week a projection of the Wall Street Journal. Okay, you can call the politics any way you want them, but saying that we'll have 40 million uninsured again in 2024 because Americans are going to pull away from high premiums under the Affordable Care Act. What do you say?
Well, so this is the second part of this, right? So the major threat to covering all of our population is whether we can make a healthcare system that gets its costs under control. And the Obamacare package had more in it that begins to walk us down that road. It starts experiments, so I called them tests, of beginning to pay doctors and hospitals very differently. Right now, the way I'm paid primarily as a physician is that I get a payment that's fixed and it's according to every operation I do, regardless of what the results are.
There's a menu, you perform that operation, here's your compensation.
Right. What we're moving towards in various ways are beginning to say that you will have either be paid more for getting better results, you'd be paid less for having worse results, and that furthermore, you would have health systems that would start to be accountable for the health of their population so that you have health systems taking much more responsibility for the whole healthcare dollar. That is, in the last 3 years, a dramatic change that is working through the system. Here's what is the shift that's going on. We're in a place where taking care of sick people actually is not what the health system is good at. The sickest are the 5% of patients who account for 50% of the healthcare costs. We've known, of course, the sickest take the bulk of the costs. Mm-hmm. That group of folks, though, are the folks who also happen to receive the worst care.
This is exactly the opposite of what we think. We think it's expensive because of that population, and they get all the attention, so surely they get the best care.
So that's the story of McCallum, and the article that I'd written was that what we see is there is a bell curve for the results you get depending on where you go for your care. And second, the places getting the best results are not the most expensive places in the country. Most of the time, it is somewhere in the middle or even at the lowest cost end because they have fewer complications, they're better organized, they have better systems in place, and they have better people working together more effectively.
If we're pushing toward a lower cost future with that kind of curve and pushing out toward the cheaper end, are we moving at a pace that makes this whole reform, this transition we're in the middle of, work? Are we going fast enough toward less expensive healthcare?
All we know is that the last 4 years have been the lowest healthcare cost growth in 50 years. And there's a variety of reasons. The economy tanking was part of it, and people didn't go in for their health care. But we're also seeing that the places that are switching under Obamacare to starting to pay more attention to the sick folks, instead of avoiding them, which is what we did when we weren't covering people, we're now seeing people use all kinds of approaches, from information technology to innovations that improve care for the sickest folks, start to change what happens in ways that improve their care and lower costs.
We are going to dive into all of that with superstar surgeon, writer, thinker, Dr. Atul Gawande. We are with a live audience of Public Radio supporters at the Paramount Theater in Boston this evening. We've got your questions from around the country and from right here in the hall. Dr. Atul Gawande, author of Complications, Better, The Checklist Manifesto, and Being Mortal, coming out this fall, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point before a live audience at the Paramount Theater in Boston. We are joined here by Dr. Atul Gawande, big surgeon, public health thinker, healthcare thinker, author of all kinds of pieces in the New Yorker magazine and books beyond on healthcare in this country, its practice in the most intimate details of surgery and at the biggest level of public policy on healthcare and how we're going to handle it. We've solicited your questions here from the audience with us right here in the hall and from around the country. I want to begin to put some of these questions to you, Dr. Gawande, because it goes right to cost, many of these questions. There's a whole series. Let me just, this is, okay, here's Boomer Chick in Florida. She says, I'm among 30 million plus Americans still without insurance. It's overpriced, has too high a deductible and copay. I'll pay the $95 fine if it comes to that. Why should I subsidize already rich doctors and quote unquote nonprofit hospitals rolling in dough? Hold on to Boomer Chick there. Here's another one from the hall. How do we improve healthcare and lower costs when healthcare has become such big business, i.e. fancy cancer centers everywhere? If we build it, they will be diagnosed. We sell sickness. Please comment. Here's another. Why have national health expenditures grown at 2 to 3 times the rate of inflation for decades? None of the studies that I've read, says this listener, answers this conclusively with data to back it up. How do we make change pervasive? Good ideas are in a bubble, do so little good. But let's speak to cost. And what is at the heart of it?
So here's the system we've built. If you are the sickest, which means that you are folks who are likely to have the greatest needs and be the bulk of the cost in the system, we have only 3 ways that we take care of you. Our system is, if you can be taken care of in a 20-minute visit, then that's okay. But hey, if you're, you know, if you're elderly, you have 5 different problems, 6 different drugs, 10 different specialists, 20 minutes ain't going to work. So what do we do next? We send you to the ER for your problem.
You mean because something goes wrong and
yeah,
we haven't fixed it in the 20 minutes?
The answers are either we say, well, I can only do this one thing and then come home and come back some other time. Or else it's a problem that we can't ignore, and then we say, well, go to the emergency room. If we can't fix it in the emergency room, then we say, well, go into the hospital. And guess what? Those are incredibly expensive ways to take care of folks who have serious problems.
But don't serious problems require serious infrastructure, require, I don't know, all the equipment's in there, all the expertise that's in there?
I'll give you an example that I wrote about in The New Yorker in an article called The Hotspotters, where a team in Camden, New Jersey said, you know, we're going to pay attention to the 5% who account for the 50% of the healthcare costs. In fact, this doctor, Jeff Brenner, mm-hmm. at Camden Coalition, he identified the 1,000 patients who accounted for 30% of the costs in the city.
Okay.
Just 1,000. That's half the number of patients that are in a typical family physician's practice. And he said, I'm going to start taking care of some of those folks. What did he find? Well, he found, for example, a blind diabetic who had blood sugar levels that were through the roof. They would come into the doctor for their 20-minute visit. They'd dial up another dose of the insulin, keep increasing. He was going blind. He was having kidney failure. He had one thing after another. They sent a team into the home. They said, show me how you're drawing up show me how you're taking your medicine. They watched the diabetic put the bottle on the table, insert a needle, and draw up a bunch of air and inject it into his arm. Teaching him for 15 minutes and seeing what's happening in his home and guiding him towards being able to do better at taking care of himself, got his sugars under control and turned that issue around. Well, the team in Camden did this for 100 patients and lowered their costs 56%.
Yeah, but surely, I mean, that's a bad scene where you're pumping air into your body with a syringe.
And our system's not made to capture and understand what is the life of these folks who are deeply sick, have many, many needs, and we haven't set up the system to be able to work. Well, what is the future system? The future system is one where there might be a home visit. There might be a pharmacist you're working with that identifies, half of your meds, you don't even need them, or they're not working effectively, that coordinates among all these specialists that are there, that might use information technology in ways that we haven't invested in. And we're seeing over and over and over again, there's Commonwealth Care Alliance right here in Boston that's taking care of the sickest, the most disabled people on Medicaid, and making extraordinary turnarounds that are improving their quality of results, keeping them out of the hospital, keeping them out of the emergency room. These are folks who were costing more than $5,000 a month, and they have already cut their costs by 40% while providing real care. I tell you, the sickest have received the worst care because we have not built the system to pay attention to their needs.
Why is that? It's kind of infuriating. And I think some of those sickest, they may know that. I mean, I've known people who are struggling with illness and they feel the uncoordination of the system. They feel the disjointedness, the way that this expertise and that fly in different directions. They don't feel supported. You write that we need pit crews, not cowboys. Why don't we have pit crews already? Why isn't medicine coordinating around those with the greatest need to be both less costly and more effective?
Well, this is fundamentally an economic incentives problem. We've paid each person in the system for the piece of the work that they do, but not brought them together to pay them as a group. So it would be like building a house where you pay the electrician for every outlet they put in and every plumber, the plumber for every pipe they put in. Well, you get a house with lots of pipes and lots of outlets, but a house that doesn't stand up. And you have to pay the contractor. And in many ways, you're starting to see hospitals, physician groups, others step forward and say, we will be willing to take the whole budget for that patient's health care and make the pieces fit together around them.
Who or what is changing those incentives? Is the Affordable Care Act doing that? Is it something else? What's going to bring on this change if it comes?
All the above. So what happened when the Affordable Care Act passed was it became a signal for those of us in medicine that business as usual was over. That we who are in this line of work weren't going to be able to make that system work with the fee-for-service system we're in. And so there are the experiments within Obamacare, but our private insurers are also coming forward and saying, we're going to try new ways of paying you. Our own hospitals and health systems have started buying up physicians' practices, and suddenly you have doctors who are all individually employed to the point where today was just reviewing some statistics and 60% of primary physicians have now become employed by healthcare systems. They are starting to become organizations. One of your writers with the question says, these are becoming big businesses. This is big medicine, as I've written about. Where we're heading is a world where there are large chains of health systems that have complex technologies, teams that can tackle problems, and there's huge advantages that come from that. The thing that we got to watch out for is that these big organizations could monopolize the care to the point that they just drive up the prices instead of being innovative.
What's
about
to keep
care?
Them from doing that? I think a lot of listeners will think big corporate conglomerates in charge. That doesn't guarantee either great health care or lower cost.
That's right. The two things, I think. Transparency. So we are starting to open the lid on what the prices of the care really are. And second, starting to open the lid on what actually happens to people in care. You know, just in the last couple months, you've seen data come out about, you know, where you see doctors, for example, earning massive amounts of money under Medicare, who are the outliers. These are the physicians that are, you know, practicing in ways that are not the ways we want to see. And that kind of transparency, which has been difficult for us to embrace in healthcare, in my profession, because we fear it's going to be unfair and the data is going to be used against us in ways that don't acknowledge the complexity of what really happens in the world. But I think that there is that we're going to see what's happened in the rest of the world, which is that more transparency, more knowledge, more understanding of what actually happens in care begins to drive much greater accountability.
There are a lot of entrenched interests here. Is there a big enough or smart enough hammer hanging over the healthcare industry to assure that it goes down this road? More transparency, lower cost?
No.
So what's going to drive it?
Is there
enough legal oomph in the Affordable Care Act to do it?
Well,
not?
Understand, we're in the midst of a big experiment, and the idea that all of the recipe has been set for the transformation of a system that is nearly one-fifth of our economy,
yeah.
The idea that there's just the recipe is laid out and we just follow and it's going to go along, think of it much more like an experiment. This is the first part of the trial underway. We have to be able to learn from the first changes that have occurred and pivot and change as we move along. That's the great difficulty of the governance, that this level of paralysis and just finger-pointing and unwillingness to learn from the last 4 years to then pivot and say, okay, we've had some successes in certain arenas, other arenas not as much. One of those areas that clearly is going to need more awareness and also potentially more action is the places where we see competition go down instead of going up between health systems. We want to see health systems doing what we see a lot of them doing now, which is innovating, introducing new ways that you as a patient get care, that you can contact people through email, that you can reach your, you know, people over the web when you need to get help, that you can have people maybe even come into your home when you have very complex needs. Those capabilities are starting to appear on the horizon, but when they're in large groups that just are where you can't leave them or you can't hold them accountable, that's where we need continued policy to pay attention.
Let's make this very personal. You talked about your son,
yeah,
and how changes in healthcare law affect him. What about your medical specialty? Here's a question from David in the audience. It says, how will the Affordable Care Act affect the practice of surgery in the future? I mean, talk about pit crews and cowboys. We know there's a crew when you do surgery, but ultimately it comes down to a surgeon. How will these kind of changes affect your specialty? You spend, when you're in the operating room, what your specialty is, throat. You're cutting throats open most often, right? Am I not right?
I'm a general surgeon, and I do predominantly endocrine surgery, as thyroids and
yes,
adrenals,
yeah,
and yes, I'm in the neck.
So what's it going to mean for you working in the neck?
Well, so there's a couple things that are you know, like a shot across the bow for us. You've started to see some health systems across the country, examples, Cleveland Clinic, Geisinger Healthcare in Pennsylvania, Intermountain in Salt Lake City, who started to go to the employers and say, we will guarantee that we will have lower complications, that we will have lower costs for you, and you fly your patients to us, and we will also give you prices that are low enough that you can fly the patients to us, you can bring their families, we will get them better results, and hey, leave your area, we will take care of them.
Can that be economic, even with airfare thrown in?
It's happening. Lowe's, Walmart, Boeing and others have signed on to send their patients and they're telling their patients.
Their patients, that means their employees?
Their employees and their families.
The ones they cover.
Their employees and their families.
Yeah.
And they're telling them, no copays if you go to these places that get better results and have lower costs. Well, that is forcing the rest of us to begin to show that, hey, we can play this game too. We can offer better results. We can control the complications. We can guarantee what kinds of results that we have for your population of folks. And so in a field like surgery, number one is it's putting much more pressure on showing the value of what we do and competing with others all the way across the country. And then number two, there's starting to come much more pressure to not, for example, there's been a kind of epidemic of back surgery when we know that if you get physical therapy in the first 48 hours after the onset of severe back pain, it can avert surgery for folks. And so health systems are starting to be rewarded by, whether it's employers, insurers, and others, for starting to put those systems in place that say, hey, if you have a back pain, we will be able to move you through a whole system that includes getting physical therapy as quickly as possible and only seeing the surgeon when it becomes that level of an issue.
If people get on an airplane to fly for surgery at places that are very efficient at it and very effective at it, why won't they just keep flying across the border to Mexico or you name it, some other lower cost? We're hearing a lot about this these days.
Some are, and there's a gamble because the transparency of those systems is not at the level that we have here. But, you know, I've traveled to India. We run projects all over the world. And in India, I saw a man who'd come from Denver, Colorado for his hernia operation there because he didn't have insurance and it was one-tenth the cost. We're starting to see global expectation that, you know, there are other parts of the world that are whether it's Europe and middle-income places, that are showing us that you can get great results at costs that are, you can not only get great results, you can get equal results, sometimes better than many of our places, at costs that are well below ours.
How much of getting health and healthcare costs under control comes down to individuals' behavior? I mean, we talk a lot about dietary choices in this country, exercise or lack of exercise choices that aren't good. We see the obesity problem just in the last week. We see type 2 diabetes up again, very high. I mean, even beyond that, we've got measles at a 20-year high because people are turning away from vaccinations. How much of this change that we need to make is going to depend on personal behaviors?
A lot. Let me give you one example. Now that smoking is coming down, and we still have more distance to go, but the biggest killer in the country has become high blood pressure. And if you look at people who have a diagnosis of high blood pressure, only about 30% have their blood pressure, about 40% have their blood pressure under control. The biggest reason they don't have their blood pressure controlled is that they're not taking their medication like they should be. And then the second biggest reason is because they haven't been prescribed the right medication for getting the blood pressure under control. Well, what we see in the system is, you could yell at those patients. You could say, tough it. If you have that heart attack and you didn't take your blood pressure medication, well then, you know, too bad. We're not going to treat it anymore. The reality is we're not that heartless, and we know that we have to turn that around. And so you're seeing a couple of things happen. One is understanding that part of our job in the health system is help people be more effective at taking their medication. Sometimes they're not taking their medication because there's too many side effects that they don't like. There have been a number of different approaches that have been able to show you can get the high blood pressure control rates up to 75% and better by a combination of coaching people at home, getting them, you know, calling them up. Are you taking your medication? Why aren't you taking your medication? What do you need? And it's often not necessarily a doctor who's, you know, behind that phone call or following up. It might be a nurse, a social worker, a variety of practitioners who can be part of the team that keeps people doing better and better.
But doesn't it have to start well upstream from their medication? You know, when they've got too much salt in their diet or whatever else it is, it's bringing them toward high blood pressure in this case in the first place. How do you get to that arena?
Yeah, you're talking about wellness. And, you know, we have an obesity epidemic. We have built into our system ways in which we have, we don't have enough exercise. We haven't built our cities well. Look, there's a couple aspects of this. One is that we still have to start with the sickest and work our way up the chain. But when it comes to wellness, improving people's weight and diet and other things like that, we still are a long way from having simple solutions that you can just deploy, you know, nationally. So we're still in a discovery phase for some of these. We know what to do to reduce smoking. We know what to do to improve blood pressure control. We are not so great about knowing what the national solution is for diet, except we can do a lot better overall.
The costs are up. The health is not what it should be. The health care itself is a subject of great debate. Dr. Atul Gawande is with us. We'll come back and look at your questions, look at American health and health care. Dr. Atul Gawande, stand by. With a live audience in Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with superstar surgeon, writer, thinker, Dr. Atul Gawande. He's author of Complications, A Better, of the Checklist Manifesto, a big thinker and a big doer when it comes to healthcare delivery, healthcare thinking in this country. With a live audience from the Paramount Theater in Boston, this is On Point. Atul Gawande says we have crossed the bridge on Obamacare on coverage. We'll see how all of that plays out. You say next comes delivery, and we've talked about some of that. There's an awful lot of, you mentioned this, but technology that's brewing out there that's supposed to bring us all kinds of ways of monitoring and keeping on top of and keeping track of ourselves or whether others monitoring us. How big a role can technology, how big a role do you expect it will play? We're hearing about all kinds of things to strap on that will monitor us, tell us more, tell our medical professionals more. Are these gimmicks? Are these gizmos? Are these a big deal for the healthcare future of this country?
I think these are a big deal. You know, I was saying we don't have the ready answer on what's the policy that's going to make the country lose weight or exercise more. At the same time, you know, I wore my little Fitbit for the last couple of years. And
what does that do? I've never worn one. I should.
Well, I think there are a bunch of these products now, but basically...
These monitors.
Yeah, so you walk around and it tracks the number of steps you make. Actually, the part of it that I found most influential is it also happened to tell me how much sleep I got. And it...
Don't you know that? You know when you go to bed, you know when you get up. or do you sleepwalk? I don't know.
No, well, so what's surprising to me was seeing... even though I know when I go to bed and know when I wake up, how little sleep I got, and then how much I was waking up in the middle of the night.
Oh, it monitors that as well when you're not fully asleep?
Yeah, and I started changing my sleep habits in order to get more sleep and be better rested. The idea that you have feedback in your own smartphone or wearing something on your clip to your belt, it's starting to be a powerful tool. And it's turning up in all kinds of interesting ways. For example, there are monitors now you can have on your smartphone that can give you a printout of your heart, can follow your EKG on your heart, your heart tracing. Mm-hmm. And having constant monitoring can actually have more detail to tell you about whether someone's actually had a heart attack than just going in and getting your little snapshot EKG. The number of ways in which we can become the monitored generation, has enormous upside if we're able to use it in ways that we can feed people back and influence our own behavior about how we eat and how we exercise and how we sleep. It can also have this sense of being constantly under the glass. And so the proof that we're going to be able to use these in ways that really drive changes in behavior, we're still a ways away from that, but I think it's one of the most promising things we've seen come out.
Talk about transparency. You talked about institutionally. Will these things be beaming this data back to our medical care professionals? Is that part of what's imagined in the future, that somebody from remotely will be watching my heart rate or my, you know, the equivalent of an EKG all the time?
Well, so the dream of it is something like that. You know, that the trouble is that our current technologies, you know, we are in a 30-year-old technology era in healthcare where our systems don't speak outwards and you can't get information into it. So for example, we are starting to reach a phase where we're demanding that the computer companies that make systems for healthcare start opening up the doors. They don't make money by opening up the doors because it means that you could have people writing applications that bust that data open and start using it in ways that means they don't make the money. But it's starting to happen. And just in the last couple of weeks, something I think could be big is Apple announced a platform that's called Health. There's HealthKit, which faces the physician. There's Health, which faces the patient. And they have an agreement with the biggest vendor for health system electronic records in the country called Epic to allow people to write applications to put your information from your Fitbit or from your application into your health record and pull data out so that you can begin to use it as well.
Or both?
Your doctor, both, and your own smartphone. And when you start seeing that happen, now you start seeing much more information. Imagine, like, I as a physician, I get 15 or 20 minutes to assess what's going on with you. If I had the information to understand and distill, well, your sleep has not been good, your blood pressure has been out of control, your blood sugars haven't been well managed, and here are the snapshot of your sleep and your story of what's going on, and you're willing to share that. Now we have much more information to be able to make real decisions together on, you know, what part of this is real, what should be prioritized, how do we make this better health and keep you out of the hospital and out of the emergency room.
What's it like practicing medicine these days? We've heard a lot from doctors saying, boy, this is just getting tougher and tougher. I've got paperwork that's overwhelming me. There's so many requirements. It's not fun anymore. I've heard doctors nearing retirement age advise younger people not even to go into it. Why is that? What's going on?
Well, I think there's technology has a lot to do with it. There was a interesting, I think, truth-telling report from a think tank called RAND that looked at burnout among physicians. It found two things. Number one, physicians that work in the higher quality places have less burnout.
Why?
Than others. I think, you know, they're surmising, but it seems to be because there's more teamwork, and it is more satisfying to work in places that you can make the system work. Places where the systems don't work and where the doctors don't work together and things just are, you know, the experience for the patient isn't great. The experience for the doctor isn't any better either. Number two, though, which was fascinating, the other huge driver of burnout was that is our own computer systems. The systems that we install in our healthcare workplaces are ones that are turning us more and more into data clerks. Literally in a 20-minute visit, we're now down to seeing a patient on average 7 minutes, and the rest is predominantly data entry. That is a waste of talented people. It is a failure to make computer systems that make make care better. Instead, it has turned us into recording agents.
We've seen so many retailers, CVS, Walgreens, even Walmart and Target, getting into these minute clinics type things. We've got a question from the audience here about the future of nurse practitioners. What about moving more of our care away from doctors and to that level of expertise that a nurse practitioner brings? Do you see that as an important part of the future? Do you welcome when these big retailers come into selling healthcare, you know, next to the greeting card aisle?
Well, two separate questions. I think we've had this battle between, you know, the doctors and the nurse practitioners and the physician's assistants over, you know, who is better and who should the patient go to see. And it's a false battle. The reality is that no individual today who practices in medicine is able to master all of the knowledge and capability that we now have to execute on. It has exceeded the ability of any individual. And so we have to work together as teams, and inevitably the teams are going to be made up of a nurse practitioner, a physician's assistant, a doctor, a social worker, a health coach, someone assigned in a clinic to work with every smoking patient and help get them to stop smoking. Now, the second part of this is the CVS Minute Clinic, the Walmart Clinic, and so on. You know, this relates to the failure of a system that only has the 20-minute visit, which, by the way, is only between, you know, 8:30 and 4:30, and where are you going to go on a Friday night? And by the way, I just need a blood test, or I just need, the neighborhood-based care. And seeing clinics that are starting to open up in your own neighborhood that are open much longer hours on the weekends, and that is going to be good for people, and you're going to see lots of ways in which that happens. But those are places that are going to be more and more integrated into the system. And so this is, again, when the information technology makes it so, hey, I got my flu shot at the CVS. They talked to me about my blood pressure pills, that I'm not taking them. And that information getting to your primary care doctor, and by the way, making it so that you also are more consistently even having a primary care doctor. It frees up some of their office time. These are starting to become interlinked, and we're starting to see a web of care where it's not about either or. It's about being able to imagine this future that looks very different. You know, this is a moment where it's like working at a Blockbuster video
in with 1999. With
Netflix starting up around the corner. Mm-hmm. We're working in a system that does not work for the sick. It's not well organized, and you have all of these centers cropping up, which feel like threats to us in medicine. But in fact, they are all new portals of entry, new systems that can be taken advantage of to build a much more effective system of care, closer to home, more convenient, less likely to make the default option, well, go to the ER. I mean, you know, an ER, for 90% of people, is a failure of the system.
Here's a question from Andrew in Boston. It comes to us from Facebook. In this new age of healthcare marketplaces, is there any reason remaining why we should continue to get health insurance from our employers? The connection between the two appears to create more problems than it solves, and yet it's comforting for many people who have it. What about that link?
It's got to break.
Why?
It's, you know, imagine if you got your schooling from your, you know, through your employer. That is, you know, where you sent your kids for school depend on where you work. That's the way we run the healthcare system. You know, virtually no advanced countries are doing that anymore. And why? There's a couple of reasons. Number one is that the way people work is much more fluid. We move from job to job, and we want to free the ability of people to move from job to job. We move much, much more across the country and elsewhere. Many people are, so that's number one. Number two, locking yourself into getting coverage through your workplace has ended up absorbing all of your wages. So virtually for the last dozen years, wages have been flat, what you earn has been flat, while actually what your employer pays to employ you has been rising tremendously because healthcare costs eat up most of that that growth. What is starting to happen is as exchanges open up, places that employers can start to, in a sense, offload people to get their coverage.
So the government exchanges under the Affordable Care Act.
That's right. That we already were in a situation where insurers were shedding businesses were shedding whether they were going to cover people or not. Under Obamacare now, the choices are either starting to see people either put the folks into the exchange or cover them directly. And many, I think, are going to start to choose. It just becomes much more logical to start moving people into getting your coverage through a place like an exchange.
Should people welcome that? Employees welcome that? I mean, we saw employers offload retirement plans to 401k, and the result, there were some advantages, but a whole lot of people kind of got lost out there, and they have no defined benefit anymore. Is it a good thing for the ordinary citizen if suddenly they're dropped off of employer health care and sent over to the exchange?
Yeah, it depends on the financial deal, right? So it depends on whether the coverage and the choice of options you get on the exchange are better. But then what people are finding at the moment, the last report there was that people's options on the exchange, they had more options on the exchange. They were able to get coverage at lower cost because there were larger pools of people on the exchange, especially for people who are in small businesses. And it also has started to see people beginning to be able to make choices. You know, many people would be starting their own businesses or starting to try new things that feel locked into their coverage through their employer because their choices are limited. They have a health problem that means that, hey, if I can't start my own business, I can't do those things. And so ironically, it may be one of the ways in which we see driving innovation and entrepreneurialism because you don't have that barrier anymore.
We've just got a couple of minutes here. As you look forward, where do you look for optimism, for hope? What forces do you look to with fear and apprehension?
As I look forward, what I look to for hope is the fact that we're in an entirely different discussion. And that discussion now, except in Washington, is a discussion about how you begin to innovate in healthcare. I mean, I'm telling you, in every medical school, in every major hospital, that is a transforming discussion. Where I look with fear is still at the paralysis within Washington, because we still need problem solving to happen within within government. If we just remain paralyzed, if we can't learn from what we've learned over the last 4 years and then make the next set of changes and improvements, we will still fall behind.
Your next book is Being Mortal. Give us a hint. Where are you headed with this time out?
the next book is about how we in medicine and in society deal with the great unfixable problems. Medicine's great at dealing with fixable problems. I can fix your knee. But the two big unfixables, aging and death. And we've caused great suffering from our unwillingness to recognize that we can't always fix aging. We can't fix aging. We can't fix death. And that unwillingness to have good planning and decision-making and the difficulty of it is causing suffering.
Dr. Atul Gawande, we've just got a couple of seconds. What's your next day in the OR, dear surgeon?
The next day in the OR, I've got three cancer patients and an abdominal operation.
This week? Next week?
Monday.
We hope you keep writing. We hope you keep doing good surgery, good medicine. We're grateful to you for being with us. Dr. Atul Gawande, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our show today was taped in front of a live audience at the Paramount Theater in Boston. Before our discussion with Atul Gawande, we heard a live performance from the terrific blues and soul band Morris and the East Coast. We'll go out with some music from that performance. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Thank you guys very much. We call it Morris and the East Coast. Thank you for having us here.